Perform and Expression. This is Heather, and I will be one of your co-hosts for today. I am working with Greg, who has been on a couple of podcasts, and he is going to hopefully help me discuss the issue at hand today. So hello, Greg.
Hello. I'll give it my best shot.
Great. So just so everybody is familiar, you've been on a few podcasts recently. Can you remind us what they were?
So I was on one of the general conference reviews at the April 2011 general conference. It was Saturday morning, I think. And then I was invited on that one. And then I was uninvited on the recent Doctrine and Covenants 8 and 9. I'm afraid that by and large I was the voice of Lucifer on that. So just kind of popping in every once in a while uninvitedly.
Right. Okay. And then we have longtime Mormon Expression panelist. Are you going by Garen or George?
I'm going by Garen George. Yep. Or okay. George. I'll go by George because everybody knows me by that.
Okay. George is slowly transitioning his identity to Garen.
All right. So we have Garen George. Hello, George.
Hey, everybody. Nice to be back. It's going to be a great evening.
And then we also have Mike. Hi, Mike.
Hi. How's it going?
Going good. Are you happy to be on the panel tonight?
I am. I just hope I'm prepared enough is all.
Well, you know what? I am having the same trepidation, so don't worry.
I'm having the same trepidation, but what are you going to do?
Right. Okay, so today we're doing another installment of the Dummies series. Obviously, those of us on the panel are the dummies. And tonight's subject is a talk, an infamous talk, given by Boyd K. Packer at BYU in the early 80s. The title of the talk is "The Mantle is Far, Far Greater Than the Intellect." He gave it at a CES conference. So the audience of the talk consisted of seminary teachers and institute teachers and people who were in CES at the time. But it takes... The majority of the focus of the talk is on historians and how they write about church history and the way they portray the church and church leaders and church founders in that writing. And Packer has a problem with not only mainstream books or things written for consumption by, you know, a general Mormon audience, but he also takes exception with things that are written for scholarly journals, things that aren't really meant to be consumed by your average church-going person. These are things that are published in peer-reviewed journals that are only used in higher education and research and you know, doing history stuff. So anyway, in the talk, Packer spends a lot of time focusing on not putting your career in front of what he thinks should be your ultimate obligation, which is to the church and making sure that you are spreading the gospel and only portraying the church in the most positive light. Anything short of that, to Packer, is speaking ill of the Lord's anointed, for lack of a better term. He only wants... kind of driving this point home, beating a dead horse or whatever, but he only wants faith-promoting things written. So after he spends some time talking about the way history should be written, he then goes on to provide four cautions or warnings about what you are in danger of doing if you do spend time trying to take a balanced approach to church history or provide a complete picture of everything that was going on at the time. He doesn't think that we should be doing that, basically. So that's just a general overview of what's in the talk. And before we get into hashing out what's wrong with it or what you like about it, if that might be the case, I asked Greg to spend some time talking about what was going on in the church and at BYU at that time. There were some things that led up to Packer giving that talk. And so for the sake of the discussion, I thought it would be interesting to spend a little bit of time talking about the context, what was going on at the time. And I asked Greg to do that because he knows so much more about it than I do, and so he'll do a better job at it than I would. So, Greg, why don't you go ahead and take over from here?
Okay, so I'll now I feel very unprepared for that. But so I want to start with a disclaimer that this is sort of the gospel according to me on what happened. I'm kind of looking at events and trying to think what would make Elder Packer want to give this particular message? And, you know, what events had happened kind of in the history of the church just leading up to this? And I think it is worthwhile to start with kind of a contextual, how do we regard ourselves in terms as Mormons in terms of the search for the truth? And I want to say that Mormonism has really taken truth very seriously since Joseph Smith, that was a really important thing. Joseph taught all truth can be circumscribed into one great whole. This is a phrase that we hear over and over and over and over and over again in our lives. He really taught, you know, everything should sort of move in. And so I think they really expected, like the early members of the church, and I have a quote for this, but the early members of the church and early general authorities, they really thought, you know, this is all literally true, and the Book of Mormon is really true. When we get the archaeology, it'll show that it's really true. If we had a video camera of the first vision, we would see that the Father and Son appeared, kind of depending on, you know, after 1870, kind of when that started to be emphasized. But we would see that the Father and Son appeared and that this happened, and obviously President Hinckley is really pressing the idea that that's really foundational and that truth wasn't squishy, and that it would really be found. So President Hubie Brown, who was a member of the first presidency, even though he was a Democrat, he said – that was for you, man. He said in a quote, he says, "I admire men and women who have developed the questing spirit, who are unafraid of new ideas as stepping stones to progress. We should, of course, respect the opinions of others, but we should also be unafraid to dissent if we are informed. Thoughts and expressions compete in the marketplace of thought, and in that competition, truth emerges triumphant. Only error fears freedom of expression. This free exchange of ideas is not to be deplored as long as men and women remain humble and teachable. Neither fear of consequence or any kind of coercion should ever be used to secure uniformity of thought in the church." This, of course, was before correlation, so I guess we'll forgive him for this. "But people should express their problems and opinions and be unafraid to think without fear of ill consequences. We must preserve freedom of the mind in the church and resist all efforts to suppress it." And there's other great quotes by George Q. Cannon. There's quotes that say, you know, this stuff is true, and if it's not true, it should be torn down, but it is true and God will back it up. And I think that's the context that we have to go into this with as we move into the historical period. So Hubie Brown says this sometime in the 60s. And so I'm going to start to go through a little chain of events as kind of I see it. And there's probably other things could be thrown in, and people can throw them in on the discussion boards. But so you have this importance that all of these things are literally true. We, of course, you know, Chapel Mormons and people going to church, there is no concept that you know, that this is truth as metaphor or anything. So they really believe that all truth can be circumscribed into one great whole, and that the evidence would come in to support the truth of the church. So, late 60s, the Book of Abraham papyri are discovered. You know, we thought they were destroyed. They're discovered. The church sets historians to take a look at them, and non-Mormons start taking a look at them, and the church backs away from sort of that, I would say, pretty, you know, they were being displayed in BYU. They're not on display in BYU anymore. And why do we not want to talk about it? Well, because it becomes problematic in terms of that confirmation that we expected. The new Mormon history kind of begins. Leonard Arrington is put in as the church historian in 1972. He, of course, believes in an unvarnished, unwhitewashed view of history. I really think the central epic figure in this is D. Michael Quinn. Quinn goes to BYU in 1974. From 1972 to 1982, Arrington is in charge of church history. Quinn is publishing. Other people are publishing. All kinds of things are being published that are not they become, in this talk by Packer, faith-destroying, but the people who wrote them were faithful. but they're talking about things in a scholarly way, and things are coming to light that have never come to light before. So, like, for example, the Book of Abraham. Sunstone starts publishing in 1979, or maybe earlier than that, but they start doing their symposium then. Dialogue has been publishing since the late 60s. So you have this flowering, both on the LDS and on the RLDS side, this flowering of scholarship. And then in 1981, the Kinderhook plates that kind of have been thought to be false, well, it's a complicated discussion, but the Kinderhook plates are verified as being authentically false. And that sort of puts another nail in the coffin of Joseph as a translator. And then Signature Books begins publishing in 1981, and Arrington publishes one of the very first books called Saints Without Halos, which was a look at Latter-day Saints without, showing all their imperfections and showing them as real people. And so...
hey, Greg, was Arrington's book, was that a Signature publication?
It was one of the first books published by Signature Book. The mm-hmm. first book published by Signature Book was, I believe... science fiction writer guy that's
Scott Card
Orson Scott Card. It was like a sort of Mormon dictionary casting fun at kind of all of our idiosyncrasies.
And then so you're saying basically, go ahead, finish your thought.
No, I think I'm pretty, you're coming into the point where Packer gives this talk and he doesn't like all of this unbiased history, and it's causing problems. And you have the problem of, as we're starting to look seriously at evidence, as it starts to come in, we don't really have DNA evidence yet, but as you start, the evidence is not coming in the way that he wanted it to. And so let's not talk about it. And that's really where I think we get to this talk being given. And so that's...
I find it interesting that a couple of the things that you mentioned were within 10, 15, 20 years of the occurrence, but the two that were absolutely within that time frame, and until you mentioned it, I didn't know the time frame of the same year, was the Kinderhook plates and Arrington's first book with Signature. And that's a pretty interesting timing. And then for him to show up on BYU campus in August of that year, does the timing of the Kinderhook plates and the release of the book, I take it that both of those events were pre-July 81?
That I don't know, actually, and I wouldn't mind somebody coming in to sort of let me know. I think another significant one or two is the Sunstone Symposia starting in 79, I think is highly significant. I also Arrington and a couple of other people from Church History Office also published in 1979 a sort of a history of the Latter-day Saints, which was written from a scholarly point of view. And I didn't have that in my original list, but was reading about that earlier today. And I think that was significant because, again, it's being written from a non-spiritual standpoint, like they're writing it specifically for non-Mormon audiences. Not necessarily non-faithful, but non-spiritual.
So you're pointing to two events occurring 2 years prior and then two events happening the same year of this speech, which is okay. I follow on. Thanks.
That's at least my thought. Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Thanks.
Let me chime in here with something that I've been thinking about. When I was preparing for the top 10, apostles that were excommunicated, I did a lot of reading on I can't remember his name. One of the number one guys, who was excommunicated for post, the guy who was caught.
He had his mistress on the side for the entire time he was an apostle.
Yes, and his excommunication happened when. Why am I so brain dead today? When David O. McKay was first new to the 12 apostles, and there was a lot of talk about how David O. McKay was kind of from a different era than the rest of the people that were in the 12 apostles at the time. The older members of the 12 apostles were used to a time in church history when the government was an obvious adversary and they were obvious outsiders, and they kind of knew things weren't, I want to be as neutral as I can here, but they knew things weren't as simple and easy as people like David O. McKay thought. David O. McKay kind of came in during an era when the church had, I don't know, civilized, for lack of a better word. And I don't mean that for the church itself, but I mean the West was settled and it was more modern and more, you know, more urban, and the church was simple. Like, all of the really hard struggles were over, all of the really big conflicts with the government were over. And so it seemed to me like with David O. McKay and the people that came in after him, they have a different experience with being in church leadership. Do you know what I mean? Because it's more just about the simple good truths of the church. There's not all this tension going on with persecution and problems with the government. And so you had kind of this loosening up. And by the time you get to the late 70s, I mean, how long has gone by since anybody who was practicing polygamy was in any position of authority, or anybody who knew of the struggles that happened that when the pioneers first came to Utah? All of those people were, you know, had died, and it had been taken over by a new generation who were used to a very peaceful, good time in Mormonism, where they had been fed all of these wonderful stories about all the wonderful things that happened. And people don't typically like to talk about the bad things that happen, or the struggles, or the things that maybe aren't as simple as, you know, as you want them to be. So you have this church leadership who were used to that setting in the church, and so they thought, well, let's go ahead and start, you know, really delving into the church history and talking about all the wonderful things that happened. And they found out that it was a little more messy than they thought in the beginning.
Yeah, a lot of things. So, like, for instance, No Man Knows My History by Vaughn Brody is published in the mid-40s or mid-50s, right? A lot of historical work and documents and things were uncovered in the time between when she published it and, say, the 70s, and she republished it with additional information. There was a ton of scholarship. There were tons of documents that kind of were unpacked for the first time. So it, you know, that had come across the plains or whatever and sat in a case. They're just, and I think to your point, the church is becoming global as it goes in, or it's beginning to spread out beyond Utah. You know, we are definitely, David O. McKay says, stay where you're at, and we're trying to go get converts everywhere else. And the big PR campaign, probably spearheaded by Gordon B. Hinckley, is happening and starting to happen, and we're starting to try and sort of integrate and really become something beyond just Utah. And so, you know, the scholars think it's really important. But the same thing was happening also with the RLDS at the same time. The issue of scholarship, maybe it was just in the water, but everybody felt like they needed to be really being real scholars about their history. The problem with Mormon history is it's just too recent and too well documented.
Well, I think the other thing that it leads to is this sense that you mentioned about the global growth and the numbers growth. Up until a certain point, there was a willingness to be open because they could kind of control the narrative. When it's mostly a Wasatch Front or a Utah or Utah-Idaho, Nevada, got to include Mike here. Thing you can make this happen, and you can make course adjustments if something comes up. But when the narrative and the story starts moving outward, in addition, not only outward but also increase in numbers, you have to control it a little bit more, especially if there's faith unpromoting things that occur. And several times in this talk, he makes mention of this, about the milk versus meat, the advanced testimony versus the beginner testimony. Outside of the Wasatch Front, where your whole existence is built up around the church and people in the church, these things are a little, can make more effect on you than it does if it's if you're outside. I mean, you just need to be able to control that narrative a bit. Mike, what's your thoughts? Where are you at on this history portion?
I understand. The point I took from the talk is avoid negativity. When you break down the gospel to its simplest point, the whole focus is on the atonement of Christ, and we're all trying to be a part of that. And when we tear down each other or you know, some character from history just for the sake of having some interesting reading, it destroys a person's faith in their ability to achieve being part of the atonement.
So I totally agree. What I'm wondering is, do you see any reason for that type of a message to come out to the seminary teachers in August of 81? Do you think there's any particular reasons why, from your perspective, that this talk would have been needed to this group at that point by this guy?
I think like Greg said, you know, when they came to Utah and they had all the records, they sat in boxes for years. I mean, Greg, when did they first start cracking open all those boxes up in there?
I really don't know. I mean,
it was late.
It was whenever Arrington took over that all of the stuff started being opened.
I mean, Arrington was starting to do work in the, say, in the mid-60s and the late-60s. You know, and he took over in 72. And people were getting access to the archives then in a way that they hadn't before. And that was mentioned in the talk 10 Years in Camelot, that is also kind of thinking back on the Arrington years and was written in dialogue.
Right. So, I mean, let's if we step outside of the church and look at it, let's say we want to look at Abraham Lincoln. He's a hero to Americans and particularly, you know, those that have ancestors that were freed slaves. You can look at his life and look at all the positive things, and it makes you feel pumped up for America and being an American citizen and what a great country I live in. But if you dig into his past, you look at things like he's selling off railroad properties as they're building a railroad, and he's got all these back side deals going on. You know, there's two histories to every character. And if we want to help, and when you're looking at a religious history, you know, you don't want to tear apart all the founding guys that did all these amazing things just for the sake of having some interesting reading.
Why is it just for the sake of having interesting reading, Mike? Because this is clearly – this is a perspective that a lot of people are espousing. But why do we assume that it's just for interest as opposed to empathy and understanding? Why do we assume that it's just flippant?
Can I back you up on this one, Mike?
Go ahead.
I think I was thinking of two things as Mike was talking. First, I think the reason that Packer came down on this, I personally, while I don't believe anymore, I do not think that the 12 apostles and the leadership of the church are conniving bad people.
Right.
They are genuinely good guys who honestly believe that this is the path. The church is true. This is what will bring people happiness and goodness and all that. So you've got Packer looking at all of this stuff that's coming out of church history and damaging people's faith, and he's like, wait a minute, quit focusing on that. You know, this isn't something that we need to be dredging up. You need to be focusing on, you know, the good, solid truths that are in the gospel. And I think what it shows is a difference in not only the time. I think there are cycles that go in a society. You have periods of time where the media, and that includes like history books as well as like radio shows and television shows and magazines and books, the good guys are 100% good and the bad guys are 100% bad. And you've got the hero, you know, bad guy thing going on. But then you go through periods of time where moral ambiguity becomes more, I don't know what you want to say, in fashion. And so good guys start to have a weak side and bad guys start to have redeeming qualities. And I think that there is a certain group of people who will take the frailties of man and use them to completely dismantle something that is worth believing in. And then there are another group of people who like to know, like you said, to have empathy for the situation or whatever. It doesn't destroy them to know that everything is not, you know, 100% black and white, that good people have bad qualities or that weaknesses or whatever. And I think that the problem is that people like Packer worry that the only thing that will come out of talking about the bad stuff is driving people away. Is that right, Mike?
That's how I thought. I mean, we spoke a couple podcasts back about how everybody has a bias. When you're coming in to discuss the gospel, you have your baggage with you, and so you're speaking from that perspective, and you can't help but talk about it with a bias. And, you know, take Quinn, for example. He speaks, and he delivers the history, but he does it in a negative perspective.
Well,
and
but
you can't help reading it and take away, well, you know, everything, every of these people he's talking about are charlatans or whatever, you know.
But he's not saying the people are charlatans. Quinn is an interesting person. And Quinn, this really becomes, I think, this is, again, the gospel according to me on this. This becomes this epic battle of Quinn versus Packer. I mean, it's like celebrity death match, Quinn versus Packer, right? And goes on and on, and Quinn eventually gets excommunicated. But when you listen to Quinn, or when you read what he writes, he believes emphatically that the church is true and that Joseph was a prophet and that the Book of Mormon is true. And he believes emphatically in talking openly about all of these issues, quote unquote, so that the saints can be inoculated, because you take a poor sap like me, who taught seminary for 4 years, who taught gospel doctrine for 3 years, who never read the anti-Mormon anything. I only read General Conference and the scriptures and the Ensign and some nibbly and stuff, but not even much of that. And I discover, and Quinn even points out in his response, that this is what's going to happen. I'm like, yep, you know, casualty number one. But I discover that the history has been whitewashed, and it just blew me right out. I mean, I was just, I'm done, because I can't trust you people at all if you're lying to me. And there is no definition of lying that this does not fit under.
This is always an interesting dynamic, because I think all of us can defend an organization's perspective to protect its reputation and its history. We all know governments, we all know corporations, companies, local businesses, politicians, who have a vested interest in controlling what's going on in their story, not only currently, in the future, but more importantly, a lot of times in the past. And I think all of us are probably comfortable to some extent with corporations controlling some of the story that's told about them. I mean, that's what PR is all about.
Yeah. Yes.
The problem comes is this really interesting dynamic when you have an organization protecting their narrative and teaching honesty at the same time.
And teaching that they have the exclusive truth, and that this is the exclusive truth, and that, say, the book of, or the first vision narrative, as it's presented in the 1838 account and none of the other three accounts, the 1838 account version of the first vision is intrinsically important and essential, or the church is a fraud.
So, I mean, that's a detail, but it's just that idea of saying, we want to control the narrative, and what happens when the narrative is not inducive to what we want for the future of our organization? Are we honest about our history, or are we going to hide those facts, or correlate those facts in some way that could be construed as inaccurate? And I think that's the problem that we have is you have this thing, and a lot of people will say, yeah, we have an obligation to defend righteousness. Well, to what extent will you go to defend righteousness? Well, in the church, we have a perfect example of that. We are given very early on in the Book of Mormon an example of, well, it's okay to murder to defend history and narrative and the writings of the Book of Mormon. So if it's okay to murder somebody, then it's okay to be less.
To lie a little.
And I think that's what I always run into when I come up with talks like this, is I get it. One of the key paragraphs that I found, we really probably ought to get into the talk, but
kind of covering a lot of it already.
One of the key quotes that I found is in on page 8. If anybody, we'll have a link to, I'm sure it's on the blog to this. On page 8 in the talk, it says, and this is a quote from President Packer, "In the church, we are not neutral. We are one-sided. There is a war going on, and we are engaged in it. It is the war between good and evil. And we are belligerents defending the good. We are therefore obliged to give preference to and protect all that is represented in the gospel of Jesus Christ, and we have made covenants to do it. And I'll put in my conference thing, unquote, or close quote. I see in that paragraph moral justification or self-justification or self-delusion, however way you want to put it, the permission to hide history or to change history in order to protect and defend good against evil. It's when you have a church saying, don't do that, out of the other side of their mouth to the rank and file, and then they're willing to do it. That's where I think it is. But I think President Packer had it in – I mean, when you go into it with that mentality, that's – you know, think about World War II and all the lies and deceit that goes on to deceive the enemy or any war or company to company or, you know, things like that. I think it's a common thing that occurs.
Guarantee it. The issue here is some of the words you've been using. Like, go back to a minute ago when you were just talking about Nephi murdered Laban. You use the word murder. That changes everything. It's just like another couple podcasts ago, they said Porter Rockwell murdered all these people.
Well, okay. You're
choosing the word murder over killing.
Okay,
go ahead. Let him go. Mike, go ahead. I think I know where you're going with this. Go ahead.
Now I forgot the other thing you said. You made another mention where you're choosing one word over another, which changes the perspective on the things you're viewing. It's not deceiving by not talking about some of the ugly things in history.
Oh, yes, it is.
You ignore those.
Yes,
no,
it is, Mike.
You ignore things and you focus on the positive.
Okay. I did this in the DNC 8 and 9 podcast because I just can't get away from this, and I have to do it again here. I have it underlined. It is emblazoned in my brain. In Gospel Essentials Manual on page 181, under dishonesty, we can intentionally deceive others by a gesture or a look, by silence or by telling only part of the truth. Whenever we lead people in any way to believe something that is not true, we are not being honest. Satan would have us believe it is all right to lie. He says, yea, lie a little. There is no harm in this. Satan encourages us to justify our lies to ourselves. Honest people will recognize Satan's temptations and will speak the whole truth, even if it seems to be to their disadvantage. Elder Packer, President Packer now, speak the whole truth, even when it seems to be to your disadvantage. If you represent God, God will back you up and the Holy Ghost will testify. Otherwise, you are lying and you are breaking your own commandments. Clear as day, there is no way you can say that covering up the ugly little bits of church history is not lying. It's definitively lying by the church's own definition that we are teaching in Sunday school and that we teach to converts.
So
how could
Mike,
you not get blown up by that?
So hang on, Mike. I think this is the core that's bugging Greg and I, and I was going after a little bit. I think that's the rub is, yeah, we get saying one or we get saying the other. But what gets the goat is when, in our perspective, the church, the institutional church, says both. That yes, that they tell us be completely honest in everything, and it's okay to lie. That's the struggle. That's what's really rubs at this thing from an integrity perspective.
Who's saying to lie? He's saying leave it and move on.
You can't,
Mike,
if you leave it out, you are lying.
But Mike, here's the thing. Packer doesn't stop at just saying move on. He says if you're destroying the faith of other people by talking about factual things that happened, by talking about truth, that you are excommunicating yourself from the church, you are choosing your profession over the church, and that you're doing something that's wrong. Nobody's saying that we have to spend every Sunday school or every relief society or even once a month. We don't have to spend any time at church talking about the bad things. But to say that you're horrible if you ever talk about them, that's a completely different thing. Nobody's saying that you have to focus on it all the time, but it's the fact that the leadership of the church is telling people that they can't talk about it at all. They have to pretend it never happened. They have to cover it up. They have to give not quite honest accounts of church history. And that is lying, according to what Greg just read.
He's asking people to have a positive attitude towards the history of the church and not make just a spectacle of every bad thing that happened to every person.
But
because what they're actually doing is discussing the history of a faith. And if you approach that history of a faith and just bring up all the sparkly negative things that make a splash on paper, then you're not serving the covenants you've made to Christ.
Hey, guys, let me recommend that another possible explanation for this talk. I'm convinced that given the fact that this was given in August of 81 and I started BYU a couple weeks later, I think this talk was intended just for me. I mean, this was my future, that month's teachers at BYU were going to be having me walk into their classrooms, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and they knew I'd be a skeptic.
So were you a feminist, a gay, or an intellectual?
I was just looking for good-looking women on campus.
Okay. So we just ruled out one of them.
Okay, before we go into that, let's talk really quick. The talk is about what church historians are doing. And Fair says that Packer's audience was very clear that he was talking to church education staff. However, the whole entire talk is about historians.
Yeah, and Quinn says it's obvious he's talking to historians and that he's talking to him in particular, Quinn, or he can address us it that way.
Right. So there's a little bit of controversy there as to what really was the purpose of this talk. Why was it given there at BYU? Because it was at BYU. So Packer can say that it was for specifically the teachers, the CES people, but the whole entire thing is about historians. So there's definitely a little bit of controversy there. Supposedly it was going to be published, and I don't know the veracity of this, maybe I shouldn't even be mentioning it, but Quinn claims that this talk was going to be published in the Ensign, and that it never happened because of some behind the scenes.
Yeah, and Levina Fielding Anderson says that as well.
Right, and you can read about all of that in Quinn's treatise or however you say it about being a historian.
Was he, the title says Elder Boyd K. Packer, was he in the Quorum of the Twelve at this time?
Yeah.
So one thing I clearly remember from going to at least the Tuesday firesides or the devotionals on campus at the time, and I think it would the same logic applies here. We kind of knew that the general authorities in the 70s would show up, and this was their time to kind of talk off the record, give us their theories. It was always fun going to some of these devotionals because we got to hear what their theories were and what they thought. So it was kind of the mood around campus all during the 80s that when these guys came to talk, it wasn't – you didn't take it and use the same material the following week in your Sunday school class unless it got included in the Ensign or whether it was brought up at General Conference because it was just a proving ground for them.
But this isn't given to students. This
I agree.
Is only
this
given
is,
to
this is. I'm just saying that it's in that context that I'm wondering whether he showed up. And remember, this is way before anything of even recorded. I'm surprised this actually even got recorded like it did because unless he was intending for this to live on after the fact. So obviously it's had a little bit different effect than him just getting up and talking off the cuff to these folks if they were planning on distributing this out to the broader CES community, all the instructors. It'd be interesting to know what was intended from his perspective from this talk.
I know I read this, and it was given to us when I was a seminary teacher. And ironically, I know I had a different I read it with different eyes.
Well, Greg, you said you saw it in different eyes at the time. What were your eyes at the time?
Well, I really, 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 really liked Packer at the time. There's a methodology he uses in this, or sort of this. It kind of like Hinckley saying, "Oh, these are little, whatever, little nothings in our history." And Packer dances around and doesn't really talk about anything that he's actually talking about, which is the MO. And I just thought, okay, yeah, be, you know, help people have faith or whatever, and don't talk too much about polygamy. You know, I didn't know what he was talking about, and I was willing to give him the benefit of the doubt.
Well, the real issue isn't writing history of the church. The real issue is the attitude with which you write the history of the church. That's what's really the issue. He goes in, on page 13 to qualifications for teaching the gospel. And he goes on to say you have to have a testimony that Joseph Smith was a prophet of God, that he saw the Father and the Son, that you have to have a testimony that this is the true and living church. And the reason is scriptural. I mean, it's in the Doctrine and Covenants. If you're going to preach the gospel, you have to preach it by the power of the Spirit. And you try to create an environment where those who are hearing you also have the Spirit so that you're edified together. And if you write history of the church and all you're focusing on is the negative, then you're not creating an environment for the Spirit, and you're not teaching to the level that you've covenanted to teach.
So, Mike, do you think he intended it to be that kind of one-sided that you just indicated, that if all your – I don't see him writing and speaking and saying don't write to the negative. What he's saying is don't write to the accurate unless it's positive.
Yeah.
That's what it feels more like. I don't see the lack of the negative. I see the lack of the accurate.
Accuracy is an issue. It's can you tell the negative thing that happened in this person's history, whatever church history character it is, and show how they overcame it or show what they learned from it? Or can you just say this guy screwed up and how can he be a prophet and he screwed up like this? You see,
so, you know, Mike, I understand why this is your take, and I don't really have a problem with it because you're a believer. And I think that the difference comes in that for some people, myself included, after a while, it's not just taking a negative approach on things. After a while, it becomes a question. It starts to build up a case for there being something wrong here. It starts to build up a case for they're covering things up that prove that this church isn't true, and they just don't want me to know about
right.
it.
Well, there's nothing that proves the church isn't true.
There's plenty that proves there's plenty that proves the church isn't true.
Well, if you look at the bottom of page 10, he says when he's talking about when he was invited to be part of some kind of panel by some university professors.
Right.
And on the bottom of the page it says, and then the spokesman said, "We're all active and faithful members of the church. However," and he said, "I told my two hosts that if the announcement had read, 'We are active and faithful members of the church, therefore,' I would have joined. But
right,
because of the however, I refused it."
Right, because from the perspective of the faithful member, there is absolutely no willingness or no – I can't think of the word I want right now – but there is absolutely no way that you can ever approach anything with a critical mind thinking that maybe it's not true.
No, you can have a critical mind. There's nothing wrong with it. It's like the old sign that sat on President Kimball's desk. Attitude determines your altitude.
That's not what I meant by negative mind. I meant skepticism. Like Packer was saying by that line that he would not join that group because they were not starting from the ultimate position that the church is true, end of story. And
the
I
way
understand
they covenant
that that's,
to.
How,
okay,
how do
you,
you
know?
Know?
I think we should probably move on from this because we're not – okay. Just I think it just shows the – absolute dichotomy between where a believer is coming from and somebody who no longer believes.
Yeah,
you look back on things like this, and it looks like covering up.
It looks like a con.
You have something to hide.
Yes.
It looks like a con. Exactly. It looks like a con.
I want to say, I actually thought when I – so, you know, I disaffected from the church in February, let's say. I'd been sort of – getting to – I've been – for several years I've been at the point of going, I don't think I can say that I think this is true. But in February I just said, I can't do this anymore. And so you talk to your mom and you talk to your friends and everything and they – what happened? And why are you lazy or offended or sinning? And what happened? And, you know, I don't want to tell them everything that happened. So I found this talk and I thought, this is perfect. I could just point to this because this is so obvious. I mean, this is really what I was thinking. And Mike, I mean, you're pointing out how naive I was even now. And I will just say, well, just read this talk and you'll understand. I can't be a member of this church because this church doesn't care about objective truth. We don't care about We don't care about the truth. We only care about supporting our position. And thus, the truth, you shall know the truth and the truth shall make you free, is not an objective of this church. And so I'm done. And if God wants to send me an angel to talk to me about it, or if he wants to help me understand, that's fine. But nobody has been able to help me understand. Well, so I had three different people, in my sister and a couple of good friends, who they sort of took me up on that. And they read the talk and they're like, well, this just makes me feel good inside. And it makes me want to bang my head against a brick wall.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that was so interesting and so frustrating. And then, and I'm like, okay, well, I guess I'll abandon the nice attempt. And when people come and ask me about it, I'll say, polyandry and Book of Abraham, Google it. And then you can talk to me, we'll go from there. And so the fact that you see it that way, Mike, I agree with Heather. It doesn't come as a shock at this point, but boy, I don't know how. I mean, this knowing what he was saying, knowing that the idea that he has that is sort of furthered when you look at his conversation with Quinn in a different in Quinn's Sunstone talk, this the truth destroys thing. Psh, I'm out of here, man. I don't even give a crap. Like you, I will stand before God and say, you made this too hard. Like how on earth was I supposed to think that was your true organization when they didn't care at all about actual objective truth?
Hey, George, you've been quiet for an awfully long time. Do you feel like we're so far off the rails that there's just no point in chipping in here or chiming in here?
No, I'm doing good and staying away from Angry Birds, so I'm doing great.
Okay.
So, there are some interesting things. When I read through these, I can say even now where I'm at, there are some parts of it that I can relate to, I agree with. Where I kind of go off the rails a little bit is some of the examples he brings up and things like that. But
there's this quote from President Joseph F. Smith on page 3. That gets brought up over and over again in the talk and has to do kind of with infallibility or teaching infallibility. And it's right before the caution. So Joseph F. Smith says, there are those who see in every hour and in every moment of the existence of the church from its beginning until now, the overruling almighty hand of him who sent his only begotten son to the world to become a sacrifice for the sin of the world. In every hour and in every moment, God's hand directing the church. And that's what Packer says over and over again to teach, that in every, and he uses that language over and over again, in every hour and in every moment, the hand of God directing
Quinn,
the church.
I think Quinn really pointed out the problem
hammers
that
on
very
that.
Well.
And that, what was that?
That you, now I'm having a brain fart here, but basically that you remove the humanity of the prophets, that they are completely infallible, that they nothing that they say or do is wrong, right?
That they can't, in fact.
Right, that they can't. And that causes a lot of problems. I mean, what does that do for Adam God?
Yeah.
What does that do for you have to kill somebody who marries outside of their race on the spot?
No, the point is the church is true, but the men aren't always. And God himself said that. The church is true, but the people in it sin and make mistakes.
You know what
He's
Lorenzo
saying,
Snow said?
Church.
Lorenzo What's Snow that? Said, I thanked God that he would put upon a man who had these imperfections the power and authority which he placed upon him, for I knew I myself had weaknesses and I thought there was a chance for me. He said he was talking about the imperfections of Joseph. I thanked God that I could see the imperfections of Joseph and the negative things about him so that I could know that I was going to be okay.
That's right. Beautiful. That's perfect.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's totally incompatible with Packer's teaching.
Right, exactly. Packer says, don't you dare talk about the bad things that people do. Don't you dare talk about the fact that they're human. We know the prophets are human. Don't talk about it. Talk about how they're prophets.
Right. Focus
that's what
on
the
whole
positive.
Yeah, well, when we focus
that
on
completely
the positive.
That completely undermines what Lorenzo Snow just said.
So Mike, I was at a young men's priesthood commemoration camp out about 3 years ago, and I was right in the middle of reading Rough Stone Rolling. And at that point, it was an evening campfire, and all the adults, all the boys were standing, sitting around. And it was this round robin of the adults where we were supposed to bear testimony of the truthfulness of the restored priesthood and of Joseph Smith. And I was right in the middle of this whole crisis mode, you know, and I was in the middle of reading Rust on Rolling. And I thought, okay, the story I'm going to tell is a story on Zion's camp where Joseph gets into an argument with one of the guys on the camp because the guy shot Joseph's dog because it was barking too much. And Joseph Smith ends up throwing the camp trumpet at this guy and really beans him with it. And it really, to me, showed what was going on and showed a very, very human element to Joseph Smith. For me personally, what I got out of the story was at least something I could say Joseph Smith was, you know, at least he had the decency to throw a trumpet at a guy for killing his dog. That was one thing. But the other thing was, is I wanted to have something new to teach these kids. I got called on it afterwards by my bishopric. And according to this, I should never have told that. Either because it put Joseph in somewhat of a negative light that he would actually have the audacity to get angry and throw somebody and hurt somebody with the trumpet. I mean, it was just like, you got to be kidding me. For Packer, he's basically saying, hey, those stories are best left off the radar. We don't want those. They should just be left off. And unless it's, you know, what Joseph actually did was he went up and forgave the guy for shooting his daughter. So I don't know what they'd have us tell him.
Like, it has nothing to do with him being a human and him being imperfect or whatever. It's just that he's not a prophet. So I'm done. When Hinckley says the first vision either happened or it didn't, and it makes the church either a fraud or it makes the church true. Amen, brother. I'm totally faithful to Hinckley's statement. I am 100% dyed-in-the-wool faithful to that statement. Yep, makes the church a fraud. We're done. Thanks. Let's go on to the next subject.
The next subject being the first caution in the talk.
Let's go to that.
Who wants to read it?
Mike.
Let's see. There is no such thing as an accurate, objective history of the church without consideration of the spiritual powers that attended this work.
I 100% agree. I think that is an awesome statement.
Yeah. He goes on to talk about somebody writing a biography of Mendelssohn and not talking about the music he wrote. I personally think that this particular caution is a straw man because
totally.
Nowhere was there somebody writing a history of the church or talking about church history and not talking about the fact that Joseph was a prophet of God.
Or had revelations or had spiritual experiences. You just don't get those types of histories being written without a mention of them. That's where I kind of – when I said earlier that I agree a lot of times with his caution – then after that in the examples I kind of lose it.
Yeah.
That's what doesn't make sense is he uses these one off examples or straw man arguments that are so easily picked apart. And I'm sitting there going, okay, Elder Packer, you're a smart guy. Why pick easy ones if you know that there's going to be intellectuals? I mean, you're basically speaking to the intellectual community or secondarily to them. Why make your argument so easy to pick apart?
Yeah. Why are you lobbing softballs like this?
Yeah. That's what I didn't get because I agreed totally with the statement. You can't write about the church without talking about the spiritual impact that it had on the people, on the members. I mean, it's just impossible.
And Quinn calls it out too, and he says, this doesn't make any sense at all because there is nobody writing about the church without taking into consideration the prophetic calling of Joseph Smith, talking about his spirituality, et cetera. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
I think what Packer's beef here was that at the same time that, you know, Michael Quinn was writing for BYU stuff, I'm sure he was also publishing in journals for, you know, other universities or, you know, other scholarly works. And he was using their lingo. And what Packer wanted him to do was to write as if he was constantly bearing his testimony, because that's what you're supposed to do as a witness for the church, right? That you shouldn't be saying alleged to have believed or this kind of thing, which he also addresses early on in the talk, that you can't write about the bishop's authority to be a counselor without talking affirmatively as if it is 100% fact that the rest of the world should recognize that he is getting prompting from God on what to say, basically,
right.
What he says.
All eyes are on us now. All eyes are on us.